The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Duke-Masaba, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Well, it's time for the Ben Jarofsky Show as I speak. It's Friday, September 17th, 2021. Here's a headline in the New York Times. Here's a headline that nobody saw coming. And don't act like you did, people. Really, come on. Don't act like you knew this was coming. U.S. defense pact with Australia enrages France. Rift over China policy. Nuclear submarine sale raises stakes in the Pacific region. Nobody saw that coming. Absolutely nobody saw that. Definitely Joe Biden's people didn't see it coming. We may have a little conversation about that just to entertain everybody with that topic, which nobody knows anything about. Without further ado, I'm going to ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself so we can take this away. Go ahead, distinguished guest.
All right, Ben, it's great to be back. I'm David Ferris. I'm an associate professor of political science at Roosevelt University and the author of It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. And it's great to be back on the show. We got a lot to talk about. You
know? Yes. So It's Time to Fight Dirty is the title of his opus. I urge everybody to run out and get it if you haven't already, or at least go to the library and read it. And David, I feel as though the Democrats may have displayed a little something. Now, we'll get to your discourse. David is an expert on foreign policy, even if he denies that he is, but he knows so much about foreign policy. Political science professor at Roosevelt University knows a lot about foreign policy. We'll get into your explanation of what the hell's going on with France, the United States, and Australia, China, etc. But it's time to fight dirty. We'll start at the top, the California recall election. You've been on the show shaking your head in dismay at the naivete and the clumsiness, to put it mildly, and the arrogance of Gavin Newsom and the Democrats in California that put themselves in such a vulnerable position. And then Tuesday? As your story in The Week put it, it just was over instant. All that anguish, all that angst, open window, throw out, voters show up and vote, pulverize the recall effort and just pulverize the Republicans, pathetic as they are in California. David, take the deep dive and explain what happened, and did the Dems finally learn how to fight dirty?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously the result of that election is very encouraging, not just for California, but I think for Democrats nationally in a couple of different ways. But it's worth just sort of going back like a month ago when I was on the show, you know, we were panicking about this, right? And there were polls. There was at least one poll that showed Newsom losing the recall outright. A bunch of other polls had it within 3, 4, 5 points, which is just crazy. I mean, he won election by 21 points in 2018. This is a state Joe Biden won by 29 points. There should not be a competitive election here, especially the particular way that it's done, according to California's completely deranged constitution, which allows to force a recall election. What is it, like 14 months before the next general election? It's just like the stupidest thing you could possibly imagine doing. I was pretty like apoplectic about the strategy of Governor Newsom, which was particular to the the mechanics of the recall, where there's one question that's like, do we recall the dude or not? Voting no means you want to keep him. Voting yes means you want to get rid of him. I was worried about that. And then there's a second part where Newsom is not a candidate anymore, and it's just like a giant jungle primary with like 10,000 people running, and you could become governor with like 8% of the vote. And so that was the situation a month ago. The person leading the second question was this this outrageous right-wing talk show host named Larry Elder, who like doesn't believe in masks and doesn't believe in vaccine mandates and, you know, just whatever other ridiculous Trump position you would impute to someone, he holds that position. And so there was a very real chance that because Gavin Newsom like went to a party last year with some lobbyists and was like seen eating unmasked in a really fancy restaurant, that California might get stuck with this like Republican nut job for at least a year, who could possibly replace Dianne Feinstein, who's, you know, looks like she's near death. And so it's just, it was like a disaster waiting to happen. And then, Election Day happened, and the polls had moved significantly in Newsom's direction, but I don't think anybody saw these results coming. I mean, he's going to win the recall election by more than he won election in the first place in 2018 in an off year, off date. I mean, who holds an election in mid-September? so it's a big win for Democrats. And, I still think that their strategy of not running a candidate for the second part was crazy. And they got lucky, but, they did win, and that's all that really matters. For Newsom, I don't take a pretty dim view of his future political prospects at this point, but certainly I think he's repositioned himself to get elected and again next year. And we won't see California, the biggest state in the country, implement a bunch of like, you know, pro-COVID policies, like, you know, banning schools from masking kids and stuff. So that's all good. That's all really encouraging. And it was good to see. It was much like the 2008 presidential election, you know, where like I sat down at the bar and then Obama was called president like 3 seconds later. I was like, I didn't even get a beer yet. Come on, man. it was over really quickly. Definitely.
I must take this opportunity, David, to offer an apology to the voters of California. I believe I called them too dumb to figure out that no meant yes. I struggle with that myself, California, so I'm not saying I'm better than you. I have dyslexia. And as David just pointed out, it confounded me that a no vote was actually a yes vote for Democrats. And it was counterintuitive. So the whole thing was preposterous. And I work from the assumption that voters in California were probably going to be as dumb as voters in the city of Chicago, who may be the single dumbest bunch of voters I've ever encountered. And I've lived among you Chicagoans since 1981. But you proved me wrong, okay? You figured it out. David, I submit to you that once California Democrats figured out that no meant yes, it was over. Okay, but it took a while. They were confused. They weren't paying attention. They were watching, you know, Empire or whatever. Go ahead, you know. So I do believe there was just a matter of a couple things. One, education, just figuring it out. And two, to your main point of your latest essay, this is what I was getting at, that Democrats are finally figuring out how to fight Republicans. You can't play around. This Joe Manchin bipartisan stuff doesn't work. If you want to win, you got to put Donald Trump's head on whoever is out there as a Republican. Put Larry Elder's head on it. Let the world see how batshit crazy the Republican Party is. Don't run away from it. Don't pretend like you're allies or, you know, every now and then you can get along. No. You got to let the world know how insane they are. And I got to give credit to the California Democrats. I believe they did that. Do you think they deserve the credit I'm giving them, David?
They deserve some of it. Okay. I mean, here's the thing. When those polls started tightening in July, that was back when we all thought COVID was over, right? And so, or maybe not everybody thought that, right? But a lot of people did. And so when Larry Elder in like July is saying, I'm against masks, there were a bunch of like, you know, blue check liberals on Twitter who were like, yeah, I can't believe they're making us mask again. Like, why do vaccinated people have to wear masks? There was a lot of pushback about the reimposition of these policies. And as the situation has spiraled out of control, I think it's become clear to a lot of people that we're upset that we had to start wearing masks again, that it's like, it's just a thing that we have to do because the situation has gotten so bad. And California then, you know, over those ensuing 4, 5, 6 weeks stood in increasingly stark contrast with some of these other states that it's not just like about masks, it's about banning local school districts from requiring their students and staff to mask, which is what's going on in Florida and Texas and these kinds of places. And it's about the vaccine mandates, which is a consequence of the frustration that I think the vaccinated public feels with the unvaccinated public. I don't know how popular mandates would have been 8 weeks ago, but at this point, people place most of the blame for the fact this is still going on unvaccinated people. It's not the only factor, but it's probably the most significant one. And so here you have the California Republican candidate for this office forced to align himself with these very unpopular pro-COVID policies, because that's where the like completely deranged Republican base is now. And the Republican base in California is just as crazy as anywhere else. They had plausible candidates. The former mayor of San Diego was a Republican who was running to replace Newsom, and he couldn't get any traction because he thinks the sky is blue and up is down. And so that just doesn't fly in today's Republican Party, where Larry Elder is, I think, he's like a feature, not a bug. I mean, this is the kind of person that the movement lines up with now. This is who they need. Like, you have to be crazy. You have to be a science denier. You have to be outrageous and say outrageous things and be just a constant lightning rod. And I think the more time went on, the more Californians realized that this was who was going to replace Newsom if he was recalled, the more they said, you know, no thanks. I mean, it's no love lost for Newsom probably, but they don't want to be turned into Texas, where parents are forced to send their kids into schools where they're completely defenseless. You know, the teachers aren't wearing masks and the kids aren't wearing masks. And, you know, have all the debate you want about masking policies, but you look at a map of the hot spots in the U.S. right now, and it's like, you know, I think it's obvious that masks are having some effect, you know. I don't like the things any more than anybody else does, okay? So don't get me wrong. I think that's what happened there. I think, you know, Democrats kind of had to tell their voters that this was happening, because why would you think there's a governor election next year. Why is there one right now? And so that's a voter education thing. I think they did a great job there. And they did a great job tying Elder to Trump, which is something the Democratic Party nationally just like could not do last year. The whole party just ran against Trump as if he was like, you know, unattached to a political movement or a political party. And they didn't do that here. And of course, there was only one office up for grabs here, but it was a good strategy. That is, you have to make sure that the voters know it's not just this crazy person or that crazy person. It's a group of crazy people, and they control the second largest political party in the United States, and they are a huge threat to take over next year and in 2024. So it was good to me that that being on the right side of pandemic policy is really paid off for Newsom. You know, this is a Democratic landslide state, right? So, I mean, you would expect the Democrat to win. But the fact they didn't really cut into his margin, the fact they didn't really even cut into Biden's margin in a weird off-year election for a governor who had lost a lot of popularity for, I think, pretty good reason, that's a good sign, right? That means that our voters next year could conceivably be convinced that there is still an emergency important enough that they got to turn out like they turned out in 2020. That is, we could maybe avoid that midterm year turnout shortfall that has plagued Democrats in every election but 2018, really since 2006, right? Those were all really positive signs that made me a little bit less apocalyptic about what might happen next year. It's always important not to read too much into a single election result, but I mean, this is a big state, right? And what happens in the California House, you know, the race for the House in California will have enormous impact on whether Democrats can hold the House of Representatives, where they have a really narrow advantage. So I was really pleased with Tuesday night. I think Republicans need to, you know, if they cared, they would have a sit down and think about, like, why do we keep opposing policies that are supported by like 67% of the public? Like, why are we taking the side of, you know, these voluntarily unvaccinated conspiracy theorists who are not popular? You know, the vaccine mandates through employers are popular. People want to be protected from their stupidest colleagues. And they want their kids to be protected from the stupidest children of their stupidest neighbors. And so that's what Newsom wants to do. That's what the American people want to do. And if the pandemic is still an issue next year, which I think it's going to be, Republicans are really in trouble on that. I mean, I still don't know how to put it. I mean, Ron DeSantis is underwater in Florida, approval rise. So I don't know. I would, if I was a Republican strategist, I would not be happy this week. That's all I can say. Thank God I'm not.
Well, and if a Republican strategist is not happy, I'm happy. Because the Republicans are batshit crazy, and I'll just say that. All right, let's break it down. Put the Democratic challenge to taking the House, I think, is all about gerrymandering, so we'll put that to the side. You hit something on it. You're absolutely correct when the Republicans have an issue, and I know you don't follow Illinois politics as obsessively as I do. Few people do. But I see it playing out in the gubernatorial primary where Republicans, a new entrant in the race this week, a guy named Jesse Sullivan, is positioning himself as a moderate. And just follow me as I explain what moderate means in the state of Illinois. Moderate means he admits that he got vaccinated, but he won't. Does not support mandates and believes it's a personal decision. That's a moderate. In other words, he's afraid of upsetting MAGA. Moderate means he thinks Joe Biden won the election, but come on, yeah, that's ancient history. Let's not discuss it, even though most MAGA people who control the Republican Party think the election was stolen. So he doesn't, in other words, in those two issues alone, he's afraid of taking a position that he will hurt him with the general public, but he can't denounce it because it would block him from getting the nomination. This is a moderate. And he's also against abortion rights. Follow me on this one, David. But his argument is, even though he kind of supports the Texas abortion bill, his argument is, I don't control the Democratic votes in the House, so what? It's irrelevant, which is hardly a winning ticket or strategy. It's not going to satisfy anybody. The anti-abortion zealots are going to want him to be championing that, and pro-choice people are going to want him to be denouncing it. I don't know how you win. Help me out here. You know what I'm saying? There's so much contradictions there. There's so much fear there. I don't know how you can win in a general election. Go ahead.
I mean, you can't. Not here. Right? I mean, the only way that Republicans were able to get Bruce Rauner into office was by convincing people that he was a moderate. And he wasn't, like, crazy on these social issues like some of the nuttier Republicans in this state are. I mean, he wasn't, like, you know, Rauner would not have supported the Texas abortion law, right? But that's the like the genie Evesification of the Illinois Republican Party. Right? It just has been obvious for years that the craziest people in the state are we're gonna take over the state Republican Party. And I just don't, like, I know that this is the line of almost every elected Republican, right? It's like, I'm vaccinated, you should get vaccinated, but I oppose any policies that are gonna increase the vaccination rate, right? And the vaccinated public, or at least a great majority of the vaccinated public, has really run out of patience with that strategy, because the vaccination rate in this country has really plateaued over the summer, because there's this, like, battle-hardened group of people that want to die of a deadly experimental virus rather than get this, like, free miracle shot. And they just won't budge unless we force them to. I don't know if you saw this polling, but so the Biden administration's vaccine mandate for private employers of over 100 people has majority support. But vaccinated people are also just, like, they're getting radical. Like, 41% of Americans support keeping unvaccinated people out of grocery stores. That means like the sentiment is growing among people who have done the right thing to essentially put unvaccinated people under house arrest. And the Republican Party thinks that they're going to march out next year and be like, it's a personal choice, everybody, if the pandemic is still raging, and that they're somehow going to win. It's like, no, man, they're going to slowly turn the screws on people and it's going to end the pandemic. That's what's going to happen. It may not happen tomorrow and we may be in for a somewhat difficult winter, but I do think that by the spring, these mandates will have moved enough people, people's children, the people that want to vaccinate their kids will have vaccinated their kids. Probably the people that want boosters will have gotten boosters in some way, shape, or form. And that means that like the vaccinated public is going to consider things back to normal. They're going to start going to restaurants. The economy is going to grow again. The unvaccinated people never changed their behavior in the first place, right? So many of them will be dead. And that'll be the situation heading into the midterms, I think, barring the emergence of a truly vaccine escaping variant, which we don't see on the horizon yet. I just don't see how this could possibly pay political dividends for Republicans outside of their like sort of fortresses in Oklahoma and in the Plain States. I just think it's a really dumb strategy for them. Here too, I mean, obviously, Illinois, right? Like, Illinois is like a Democratic state. So it's just crazy.
Well, it's curious to see how their strategy will play out in swing states. So how will it play out, let's say, in Georgia or Arizona, or even to a certain degree, I could throw Florida into that mix. Although Florida's gone Republican. Did it go Republican the second Obama election? I think Obama won it 2012. I can't remember actually right now.
But, yeah, no, Obama won it twice.
He won it twice. So it's gone Republican for Trump twice. And DeSantis is a Trump disciple. So now it's run by Republican. So it'll be curious to see how these states where it's closer to 50-50, the strategy plays. The upper hand that the Republicans have with this madness has to do with gerrymandering. I get your thoughts on this. Winning back the House will require winning elections that will take place in November 2022 under new maps. The maps that currently exist will not exist when that election is held. Throughout the country, they're remapping, reapportioning. I know my listeners are smart enough to know what all this is about, David. So if the Republicans can successfully gerrymander enough congressional seats, and I've been reading different articles about this number that say, yes, they can. Others that say it's not clear if they can. Then they could take back the House, even with this lunatic anti-mask. And as you say, there's really important to emphasize this. It's not just anti-masking and anti-vaccine. It's mandates against masking and vaccines. So what's your thoughts on gerrymandering and the impact it will have? Go ahead.
You know, it's too soon to tell. I mean, there was a study out today from the Cook Political Report, which said, based on the maps that they've seen proposed in the various states so far, they think it's possible that Republicans might net as few as two seats from just gerrymandering. Now, I don't buy that, because I think that there's an assumption that some Republicans in some states are not going to sort of plunge the knife in to the maximum extent that they could, and I think that they will. And so I think that Democrats have to operate on the assumption that we are going to be starting out the next race with down at least five seats from where we are. And that is more seats than it would take to flip the House. So if you're handicapping things, right, like Democrats are just at a disadvantage. It's not just because of gerrymandering. It's because of a long-term finding in American politics where people just like to punish the president's party 2 years in. I don't know, but my pet theory is that maybe that's because the you know, a party's core supporters seem to get like nothing that they were promised in the first 2 years. And maybe that maybe demoralizes them a little bit. Hello, Joe Biden. But certainly gerrymandering is a big concern. I think Democrats in Illinois and New York in particular, I think have shown a willingness to be a little bit more ruthless than we were expecting. And that could save a few seats, but there's just no way to, I just don't think there's any way that Democrats are going to benefit from gerrymandering. And so you have to look at the environment. Democrats won the national popular vote for the House. You know, that's just aggregating a bunch of individual races, right? It's not a perfect metric, but by about 3.5 points last year. And we just barely kept the House. And so if you just keep the national environment steady, give Democrats a 3.5 point lead for the House on these new maps, I think that we would lose it narrowly. And if you give the Republicans even a slight advantage in the national popular vote for the House, we're going to get blown out. That's just the dynamics of where our voters are. The fact that Republicans have more opportunities to draw these district lines without any interference from Democrats at all in states around the country. And there's some states where I think courts are going to mess with things, you know, Michigan and Wisconsin and Florida. These are places where courts could step in to prevent unfair maps from being put into place. And I just don't think that they will, because for obvious reasons, right? Like, because the GOP judicial strategy is to reinforce Republican power with every possible decision that they can make. So that's the state of play. You know, obviously, I think the abortion is going to be a huge issue next year. It's a potentially mobilizing issue for us. Although I don't think that that's guaranteed, because the Supreme Court kind of gutted Roe v. Wade without even really announcing that it was doing it, right? And so it's not like there was a day that was like, Roe v. Wade is gone. It was like, they kind of just turned the lights off and nobody noticed. Not that nobody noticed, right? But it's not, I don't think it has yet become a top tier national issue in the way that it needs to be, if Democrats are going to capitalize on that politically. To say nothing of like, what are we going to do for the millions and millions of women in Texas who no longer have reproductive rights? So, we got to be ruthless in our own gerrymandering opportunities. Unfortunately, I hate to say it, but we do. And Democrats really need to settle on a small number of important issues that will resonate with voters where we are on the right side of public opinion, where Republicans are being super crazy, legitimately. And tie the whole party to Trump again. That's the path, you know.
I'll put a little positivity out there, and this has to do stems in part from my utter obsession right now. I alluded to this before we went on the air with the Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton special series that's on Hulu right now. I urge everybody, if you're a political junkie, to watch it. Ryan Murphy is brilliant, in my humble opinion. The producer of this and the way he's packaging it. It's a great history lesson. But I've started doing the deep dive. I'm a little embarrassed to admit this. Not only am I watching the special, I'm reading books that I could not bear to read in real time, David, because I found that so upsetting, the whole 1990s impeachment drive. But there's enough distance now where I'm really studying it and seeing what the Republicans did and the impact it had on politics. And to this point, the impact it had in politics in the 1998 midterms. Okay, so there was a Democratic president. The Democrats picked up seats, and as opposed to the 1994 midterms, or 4 years ago, when Newt Gingrich mopped the floor with the Dems. And so that was an instance where Democrats prevailed when they had an incumbent president. And my takeaway, which I will now try out on you, is that when Democrats snooze, they lose. And Democrats get complacent. They fall in love with their president. Like they did this with Obama. They just quit. But in 1998, it was a time politically much like today, bitterly divided country. Republicans were playing a very strong counterattack against Bill Clinton and fired up the Democrats to support Bill Clinton. And the result was seen in those congressional elections that preceded by just a few weeks, the impeachment trial in the Senate. I think we're in a similar situation here where I think it's finally pierced the thick noggins of Democrats that this is an ongoing fight. It did not end in 2020, November election when Trump was quote unquote defeated, even though he won't admit that he was defeated. Do you follow me? This is like an ongoing. And I my takeaway from California is that Democrats realized that this was an ongoing fight. And the part I appreciated the most, there wasn't a lot of jubilation in the aftermath of it. It was like they figured out, all right, this is just one battle. There's like 10 more we got to go. We won this one. Let's move on. My sense is, I hate to be optimistic in any way about my beloved Democratic Party, is that they truly may have figured something out. Your thoughts? Am I being too optimistic about Democrats? Or do you think they're just going to go back to their old snoozing routine in the coming years? Go ahead.
I mean, it's a tough question. I instinctively have two different answers to this question. Okay. One, I think that the electorate is more energized heading into the midterms, like our electorate is more energized heading into the midterms based on the threat, the ongoing threat of Trumpism and what it represents for this country. And that the pandemic and the sort of the polarization of policies around the pandemic, where Republicans are forced to adopt these like ridiculous, unpopular anti-science positions, is helping to maintain that sense of emergency, because there is a small d Democratic emergency threat to our system of government posed by these Republicans. And there's now this like threat posed to your life and the lives of your children and your grandparents. And then these guys are on the wrong side of that too, right? So you have this thing that I think is more abstract to some people, which is like democracy. And I think people generally have like a hard time coming to terms with the fact that like we could actually lose our democracy. Even after January 6th, I think there's still people that are like, well, I mean, they arrested the people, so it's fine, right? And now you have that same group of people adopting positions that seem frankly designed to keep the pandemic going. And people are really unhappy, and they're directing that unhappiness at the Republicans. I would be more optimistic if I saw this in data about the race for Congress, in polling for the race of Congress, which I'm not really seeing yet, where the generic ballot has tightened for Democrats. Some of that could be Afghanistan, which I think is going to be ancient history by next year. But some of it is the sense that, I think the sense that the Biden administration was not acting aggressively enough about COVID, and now they are. Still, to be honest, not as aggressive as I'd like them to be, but they are being much more aggressive than they were. And so a national address in which Biden calls out the unvaccinated and is like, we're going to do this, this, and this to you. I think that's energizing for our voters. But we're also going to have to deliver some things out of Congress if we want to have something to run on. So it's really vital that, you know, the progressives and the moderates come to some kind of understanding about the spending and infrastructure and all the things that are stuffed into that proposed reconciliation bill. I guess it's going to happen on the same timeline that the Republican tax bills, like December 2017. So sometime this year, I assume something will happen with all that stuff, as long as Joe Manchin doesn't fall off his houseboat or whatever. So that'll be good. I've heard some rumors bubbling up that some people are coming around to a voting rights exception to the filibuster. Now, whether the two people that really need to come around on that are coming around, I have no idea. No one else does either. But you could see a world where we're coming into next summer. Pandemic is in the rear view. We've passed some version of the For the People Act, or at least voting rights reform. We've passed these big spending bills. We've got like elaborate new programs for like universal child care and elder care and all this stuff. People are getting checks every month for their kids. I mean, you could see a situation where Democrats go into next fall in a position of much more significant strength than I think that we've been assuming. And the Republicans seem to be doing, honestly, just like everything in their power to give us that opportunity. And so it's really on Democrats in Congress to make sure that legislation gets passed, that it is properly publicized and messaged and framed. One of my big complaints, in addition to it's just a stupid waste of time, what is happening right now, is that when you stuff 18 things into a reconciliation bill, it's like, oh yeah, we're going to put the voting rights in there. We're going to put care for the elderly. We're going to put new daycare programs. We're going to put the stimulus checks, and we're going to put more infrastructure. You can't then what was it? It can't be described by the press as a party line reconciliation vote, a spending vote. It's just, that's what the press is going to, media is going to call it a spending vote. Okay. And what are Democrats going to say? Instead of being able to be like, yeah, man, we passed the Dianne Feinstein, elder care law, and we passed the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and we passed, you know, divide them up so that you can run on them because they have names, because they are bills with a name, rather than this unwieldy Frankenstein of 50 different policies that you can't get through with 60 votes. And so you did it this way, which is fine, better than nothing, right? But it really, really creates a huge messaging problem.
I'll take the messaging problem in exchange for the bills. If I can't, they're so chicken, they won't do away with the filibuster. So this is what we're stuck with. But I hear what you're saying. Your thoughts on Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott, the governors respectively of Florida and Texas, who, and I guess you could throw in Kristi Noem from, was it South Dakota? Am I getting my Dakotas mixed up? It's South Dakota, right? Yeah. Sorry, North Dakota.
I always get my Dakotas mixed up. I can't keep.
I got reversals south of North Dakota. So they're taking the hard stance. They're ride or die. I'm going to just disagree with you slightly. I think that a Texas abortion bill has fired people up, and I think that wait till those first prosecutions come down, like the Uber driver who drove the woman to the abortion clinic or what have you. If it gets to that. So I do believe that'll be a strong, powerful issue come November's elections. But, Ron DeSantis, let's just talk about him for a moment. Mandates against mandates. Your essay and the week was really interesting. You pointed out how he's going to court. He's going to make school districts pay money. You're going to take money away from education to pay lawyers to fight the suits or pay fines to the state simply because they were exercising their local control. So it completely violates everything they stand for, supposedly about local control. Talk about Ron DeSantis and his policies. It just seems to me such a losing effort, but maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I'm too far removed from where the public is. Definitely I don't know Florida. So talk about Ron DeSantis and these hard stances he's taking.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Ron DeSantis has let those CPAC straw poll numbers go to his head, where he's leading the non-Trump field for 2024. As soon as you put Trump in there, he becomes the nominee, right? There's no way they're going to stop Trump if he runs. But I think there's a lot of people that think it's just a vanity project. He's going to threaten to run and threaten to run and threaten to run and then be like, nah, I like golf too much, whatever, or he'll die. look at the man. So DeSantis thinks that he has figured things out because as of 2 months ago, he had done all these reckless things with public health and he was still popular in Florida. And so he just kept at it. As of June, he was sending merchandise out on his website, beer koozies that say, don't Fauci my Florida and this kind of stuff. And so big shock, vaccination rates are not that great in certain places in Florida. And he basically sort of death marched kids back into schools in August and prevented schools from imposing mask mandates. Now, maybe Florida is not a place where a statewide school mask mandate can fly, but that's different than preventing the districts from doing it. And you are depriving them of the opportunity to implement policies that they see fit to keep their students, staff, and faculty safe. And that is not going over well. It would be one thing also if it hadn't backfired in a public health sense, right? If he had done all this stuff and then Florida's cases were going down, everybody was like, see, just like last year, where does Ron DeSantis go to get his apology? Remember this article?
Yeah, this is so stupid. Where does Ron DeSantis go to
get his apology? And I'm like, I don't know, how about the morgue? If a lot of his citizens are there.
But where did that article run? Where did that article
National
run?
Review.
Oh, whoops.
The National Review. So it was Rich Lowry, the National Review. And there's been like 50 articles like this over the last year where it's like, look at the unemployment rate. It's fine. It's like, actually, it's higher than Massachusetts. Florida unemployment rate is not that great. I mean, it's better than some, no worse than most. You're going to sacrifice like tens of thousands of people for 2 points on your unemployment rate? Okay, good luck with that. And I think people are tired of the constant situation of like death and dying. This situation is really starting to affect people who don't have COVID when they need to go to the hospital. You know, not just like there are places where the ICUs are full and you have to wait 8 hours to get your appendix taken out. It's more also like you go to the hospital for something and you're surrounded by COVID patients. I mean, that's not a good situation. People then become fearful of taking other kinds of risks. You know, like, do I want to get into a car today? If there's nowhere to take me, if I get into an accident, this kind of stuff, right? Like, so the state has just been like, just devastated by COVID. Georgia's in the same position. Texas is in the same position. And yes, I think that there's a small Republican majority in Florida, slightly larger Republican majority in Texas, even today. But this is not helping them popularity-wise. I honestly think DeSantis is in trouble for re-election next year. And he would not be the first governor to think that he's like unlocked the magic of political fortune in their first term and then start plotting a presidential run, only to find out that the people in their own state hate them. And that doesn't actually play very well nationally. Hello, Chris Christie. So, I think that they, you know, the Republican base is big, you know, it's tens of millions of people. And Ron DeSantis has the pure, unadulterated, like heroin-like adulation of those people. And it feels good. I'm sure it feels good to like walk out into a MAGA rally and be like, this is our hero. Thank you for stopping them from abusing our children with masks and this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, those people are energized, but he's lost the majority, even in Florida. It doesn't mean he won't win. But I think as of 3 months ago, I think he would have walked to re-election. And now I think he's really going to have a fight on his hands. And that really should say something to them about the impact of their policies in purple states, as you were bringing up before. You know, how's this going to play in an equally divided state? I think not good if your policies lead to like, you know, hundreds of children dying and overwhelmed hospitals and people, the rest of the country talking about you like you've lost your minds. You know, this is a public health crisis. People are being driven out of healthcare because they don't want to work in these situations anymore because they're tired of risking their lives and wearing a K95 mask for 14 hours at a clip and not seeing their families to take care of people who kind of intentionally put themselves in the hospital. And even when they're there, you know, with their dying breath, they're like, this can't be COVID. You know, I took my ivermectin. and so it's nuts, right? Like DeSantis is out there being like, we got to get everybody monoclonal antibodies, you know, send them to their houses, put them in the mail. And it's like, what if they just got vaccinated, man? Then they wouldn't need monoclonal antibodies and they wouldn't need to go take horse dewormer. And they wouldn't need to gargle antiseptic. And it just like feels like every week these idiots are trying some other thing. You know what I mean? Like, what if we blew up our houses? Does rubble cure COVID? I don't know. It's such a mystery. It is. But I don't think he's not having a good month, this guy.
It's because he's linked himself to madness. All right, we'll close with an explanation of what the heck's going on with France. I think I discovered this last night. The New York Times was sending me updates. Ding, France enraged, and it hung around as an issue long enough to be the front page. I'm laughing. I mean, this country is so obsessed with its own insanity that I often forget there's a rest of the world out there. And so, anyway, a U.S. defense pact with Australia enrages France. Please explain this one to us, David. Why is France so enraged?
Okay. So I don't know if any of your listeners are from large families with multiple siblings in them. But these families tend to have these dynamics where like two or three of the siblings are really close and like one of them gets left out all the time. That's like France with NATO. in France with like the UK and the US and Australia. France has always felt super left out by how close the UK and the US are. You know, people like to lump all these countries in together as like equal allies, but we've always had a contentious relationship with France since the Second World War. You know, France like pulled out of NATO at one point. They only fully rejoined NATO under Sarkozy. And, you know, they have their own defense industry that they're very jealous of. France is proof that even like 200 years from now, when the US is like 1/8 the size of India and China, there are still going to be a bunch of like dead enders who are like, remember Afghanistan? We were great once. We've got to sell these submarines, man. So what happened was like the Australians decided they liked our submarines better. Boo-hoo. You know, this is probably the most jingoistic I'm ever going to say. I'm ever going to sound on this show. But it's just such a ridiculous controversy, you know. And like Biden, you know, in a situation where we need every single vote in this country to save democracy, Biden is not going to be like, yeah, I'm going to torch this deal, which could lead to a bunch of people and some people getting mad at me because the French are upset about it. It's like, no, make better submarines, man. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. If the Australians want our submarines, that's what they want. And I think the Biden administration is happy because, you know, there's some sense Australia is like, it's all alone out there, you know, that's just with China. I'm sorry, New Zealand is there too, great military power. Maybe the Australians are just feeling dyspeptic because they've all been locked in their houses for 18 months. I mean, that's like another story for another show. I have a first cousin in Australia, and he has been in lockdown with his toddler for like forever. It's the policies down there are pretty out there.
Oh, I didn't mean to laugh at his situation. But,
crazy. So, yeah, it's just the French are upset that we undercut them on this deal. I think there's probably some blame to go around in the State Department for not like preparing them for this, or if they felt blindsided by it or whatever. But, you know, we don't owe the French anything in terms of those contracts. In fact, they're a competitor in terms of arms sales. I wish that we'd all cut our arms industries by about 97%, but it is what it is out there. And so, it's just like this another historical instance where the French think that we are secretly in league with the British and this time with the Australians. We are. I mean, it's like, yeah, like we are. Like, I do like my sibling better. I'm sorry. I don't have to invite you to dinner every time I have them over. That's the way it is. So lurking over all of this is China, right? And I think the Biden administration sense that they don't seem to want to walk back some of the escalation that Trump did vis-a-vis China, but they do want to shore up this sort of traditional military economic alliance that we had in the Pacific, and to not deliberately alienate various allies. And so getting the Australians back in our good graces after the Trump administration was an important goal of Biden. Who clearly sees the competition with China as what is going to define the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. So that's another story for another day, but we wanted the Australians to have a whole.
I'm looking forward to, I've really come to appreciate watching the MAGA's counteroffensives on all these issues. We've talked a great deal on the show about Nicki Minaj and how she's been embraced, the rapper, by Fox because of her testimony about her cousin's friend who has swollen testicles. That's been a favorite topic of the show for a while. So, and now she's just beloved by Fox all of a sudden. I love it when rappers say something outrageous on behalf of like Trump and all of a sudden MAGA falls in love with the rapper. It happened with Ice Cube as well. So, I'm curious to see the spin MAGA will have on this, because as you know, MAGA and its antecedents despise France. And I don't know if you remember Freedom Fries. I forget which instant when the Republicans were, I can't even remember the fight, but Republicans wouldn't call them French fries. They would call them Freedom Fries.
It was the Iraq War.
What's that?
Because France would not side with us when we wanted to invade Iraq.
I see.
France,
okay.
France opposed our invasion of Iraq. And so in the congressional lunchroom or whatever, they decided to take French fries off the menu and replace them with freedom fries. If you remember, if you read the National Review in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a guy named Jonah Goldberg who used to write a series of columns about the French, calling them cheese-eating surrender monkeys. So just like the American right, like, despises France, you know. So I don't know what sort of like rhetorical jujitsu they could employ here to take the side of France in this dispute, because then they'd have to be opposing, American arms manufacturers. I don't really see them doing that, but they'll come up with something, I'm sure.
They're shameless. I think I may have quoted this man to you the last time we're in the show. I quote him all the time. He's a frequent guest on our show. Sam Holloway is his name, and he's really one of our leftiest guests, even beyond you or me. I love him dearly. He's a dear friend of mine, Sam Holloway. And I'm always pointing out the hypocrisy of the Republicans, and he always says to me, Ben, fascists don't care if you call them hypocrites. They only care about winning. And I go, Sam Holloway, you're a brilliant man. And so I'm just waiting for it. You're right. It's going to be a tough one. It's going to be a lot harder.
I can't wait. We'll talk about it next
time. Yeah, the next time. It'll be harder than embracing Nicki Minaj, that's for sure. All right, David, it's good to talk to you as always. And I think I'm going to headline this particular show. David Ferris looks on the bright side, because this is as cheery as you and I have been in a long time. One victory in California. What a mirror. You know, it was a month ago we were pondering Larry Elder appointing Dianne Feinstein's successor. At least we don't have to worry about that, right?
That California sunshine, it does you good, you know, lifts the mood. I don't know what else to say.
Does you good.
Thanks for having me on, Ben. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always a blast talking to you. That's David Ferris from Roosevelt University. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.